requirement for automation processing is the interaction between theoretician and experimentalist. And it is surprising that people who are doing kind of very high-level theory still kind of are interested with kind of how the experiment goes and suggest and try to interact with experiments. In fact, I went to look at list of the speakers of the workshop in the last week and kind of tried to match them if they were related to experiments. Well, my criteria was not if they had gone down in the lab with a screwdriver and things like this and kind of plug things, but I realized that about half of the speakers had done work related to experiments. So we have Gilles Brassard and Charlie, who were the first to have a prototype for a cryptography, quantum cryptography, so like the first ones to have kind of dirtied their hands and try to re-bring these ideas of quantum information processing to kind of the world that we live in. And there's also Michele Mosca, was the first one to implement a quantum algorithm with Jonathan Jones in Oxford. Mike Nielsen, who has done quantum teleportation. Then there's Richard Cleave, recently who's been doing work with Ike Chuang on order finding problem in NMR. And Manny Knill, who's been doing a lot of NMR experiments. And me, who's kind of also a theorist who kind of like to dirty my hands. So you see that there's quite a relationship between kind of some of the experiments and trying to understand, can we bring these ideas and what happens when we try to bring them to the realistic world? So I'm going to go through some of the implementation, give you some of the idea and the element that we have and what are the problems that we are facing. At first, when we think about ideas of quantum information, we might think that it is similar to other powerful models of computation. Example, if you would have a classical system with infinite precision, then you could do things that our digital computers cannot do. And you could say this is a new model of computation and we should all go and try to find infinite precision classical system. But we know in the realistic world, this does not happen. This is not as powerful because noise comes in and precision of realistic device stops or kind of inhibits the power of these devices. Up to not that long ago, some people thought that maybe quantum computation would be the same thing, that it was all nice and dandy in theory, but when we'll go down to the lab, we will not be able to manipulate these systems precisely enough so that we'll be able to take advantage. Well, it turned out that, at least in theory, this doesn't seem to be true. Quantum computation seems to be a reasonably physical model for computation, which seems to have more power than classical device. I should have mentioned that this reference, Portrait for Physics, had a list of different implementation, which will go in much more detail than what I can go today. So that's kind of broad reference for anybody who wants to kind of get acquainted with the details of experiments I'm going to just mention today. So one of the really important things to understand if we want to bring quantum information to the real world is what are the main obstacles. And one of them is the fragility of quantum information. And there's many reasons why quantum information is more fragile than classical information. One of them is we deal with a lot less energy in our system. If we think of classical computers today, we can think of states of zeros and ones as a capacitance being charged or discharged as the zero and one. And we can think of a bunch of little electrons moving on one side and moving on the other side for the zero and moving again. And if you take the typical capacitance that we have on our computers today, they work about 1 volt, and that will correspond, and there's about 1 million electrons which goes from one side to the other. So the typical energy that we have is 10 to the 6 electron volt. If you go to, let's say, a nuclear magnetic resonance device at about 10 Tesla, you look at the hydrogen nuclear spin, going from pointing up to pointing down is 10 to the minus 6. In fact, some people must have very good eyes if they saw the minus 6. It's really a minus 6 compared to 10 to the 6. So there's 12 orders of magnitude difference. Already this will tell us that we'll have to manipulate things in a much more precise way that we have in our classical computers. Another reason is the control of operation on a quantum device seems to be very different than what we are doing, how we control a classical system. How do we very naively control classical system. But we let them evolve a little bit, like you drive your car, and suddenly you look in front of you from time to time. Then you see there's a car coming, or you're kind of going towards the ditch, so you observe this, and then you use feedback control from your eyes down to your hands, and then you turn the steering wheel and you keep on going straight on the road. So the idea is you look at your system, let it evolve, you make a measurement, and you do a feedback. But in quantum system, we know that if we start to measure our system, we cannot do this without altering it, the system drastically. On the classical system, it seems that we can do this very well, like the fact that you are observing the road doesn't change the direction in which you're going. But on a quantum system, we go and we drastically affect the system when we go and measure it. So for a long time, people thought that this will inhibit real control. But it turns out that this is not true. And we can still kind of going and measure system using the feedback and kind of kicking the system in the right direction. And that's what we've learned from error correction, that this is possible. Another source of error, and one thing that we have also to think when we go in a quantum system, is the type of errors become different than the classical error that we have. And error of superposition is an example of error that do not occur in the classical world, but occur only in the quantum world. And a very rough idea of errors we come in this is depicted here. This is called a Wigner function, a phase-based distribution of harmonic oscillator. So let's assume that we make the oscillator in two Gaussian states, which we call the 0 and 1. If we make this superposition, then we get interference pattern between those two. Right? It's a quantum phase-based distribution, so there's some negative probability here. And that's a sign of these interference pattern, and this is a non-classical effect. Now, if the system is completely isolated from the rest of the world, those interference terms will remain there, and the harmonic oscillator will be such that if this is X, this is P, then the 0 and the 1 will turn around X and P, and this pattern will kind of be symmetrically distributed. But if the system is not completely isolated, it'll start to kind of dissipate some energy, but not only it'll dissipate energy, which would correspond to those big blobs, 0 and 1, shrinking towards the middle of the harmonic oscillator, but the interference pattern gets destroyed. In fact, in a very simple model that we look at, it turns out that the interference pattern gets destroyed at a rate much faster than the dissipation of the energy. So the coherence terms get kind of wiped out much, much faster than the relaxation of the system. And from this, there were ideas of this is the origin of why we don't see quantum system, macroscopic quantum system in the world that we have. Wojciech Zurek has a theory called the theory of decoherence, which exactly suggests this, that decoherence is what delineates the border between the classical world that we have around us and the microscopic world where quantum mechanics reign. From the other point of view, if we try to do quantum computation, we try to get rid of this noise of this decoherence. We have to fight it. And we know intuitively, because we don't see many quantum effect microscopically around us, that it'll be very, very hard to get rid of those effects, of the decoherence. Fortunately, around 1995, 96, Peter Shor and Andrew Steen discovered error correction. That was the first kind of systematic theory that we would be able to control quantum mechanics, get rid of those errors, and compute reliably. It's like it is slightly surprising, this theory of error correction, because we can think of evolution of quantum computers as a bit like an analog computer. So we have a vector in the Hilbert space, and it's moving in some direction, and we can make it move in a very small amount, which is very different from the digital system that we have, where it would go from 0 and 1, which we thought where error correction was really powerful. However, quantum mechanics, at least we have finite system in quantum mechanics where the Hilbert space has a finite dimension, there's a finite number of operations, and that's where the digital part comes back in this and kind of demonstrate that ideas of classical error correction can be adapted a different way. Well, from the idea of error correction and the idea of fault tolerance, that led up to something which is called the accuracy threshold theorem, which says that a quantum computation could be as long as required with any desired accuracy as long as the noise level is below a certain threshold. And finally, my FX work very well. There is a number here. It's very, very pale, and it's on purpose. And it's on purpose because we don't know exactly what is this threshold for physical devices. We can make some very reasonable physical assumption and get a number which is between 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 6. But these kind of assume, again, idealized system, and we don't know if the real physical system that we want to have for a quantum computer will allow all the assumptions which are there. Kind of assumption that we have in this theorem is that we can do parallel operation. Some devices seem to have this assumption, some not. We assume that we don't lose qubit. We assume that the error don't add incoherently, not coherently everywhere. Really, to bring these ideas down to the physical world, we have to go and look at the system and see if indeed they work in that way or not. So the significance of this is that, at least in theory, we can have imperfect quantum system and still compute reliably with a reasonable amount of overhead. Reasonable for computer scientists means polynomial. This can be very still hard for experimentalists to add kind of five times the number of qubits to be able to encode them, but at least it's kind of a reasonable amount, and we'll see how they can be implemented in systems. It also gives us a criteria for scalability. We quite often hear that somebody here or there has proposed scalable devices. But really, when we say that a device is really scalable, we should mean that it obeys the CITES criteria so that we can take care of all the noise, all the errors in that system. And this value of P should be calculated for that particular device and see what it is. And up to now, nobody has done that for any of the devices that we have around. And the type of error that we have in devices that we have around today are about, at best, between 1 and 10% of error per gain, which seems to be much, much larger than what is required for the theorem. So we're still kind of there at really at the beginning. But I hope that these ideas of accuracy threshold error correction would be some kind of guide for experimentalists. They are a way to make like, the information and the manipulation that we want to do in our system in a much more robust way. It's a different way of thinking that most experimentalists have been used to, but that they seem to be essential if we really want to build a quantum information processing device. Also, the first ideas of error correction, the 3-bit code, 5-bit code, for example, to correct for, let's say, phase errors or kind of a generic 1-bit error, could be benchmarked, compare, and relate different devices from one to the other. So let's go down and think about how do we go from this theory to experiment. And I do apologize for the people who are at the workshop because they've seen some of those transparencies. But we're still a very long way from the theory that we have, implementing algorithms like the factoring algorithm, to devices who are really doing this. Like the largest number of quantum bits that have been manipulated is up to 7 right now. And Peter in his talk yesterday suggested that to factor a 200-digit number, there was about 600 qubits that we would need to if there would be absolutely no error. So we're kind of quite a ways from doing this. If there are errors, there'll be an extra overhead. So maybe, let's say, 2,000 qubits would be needed to factor a 200 number. Well, we are very, very far from this. Like Charlie Bennett a couple of days ago told me that he was impressed that we were at the level of having somebody who's bicycling, but maybe what he has not noticed is that there's a puncture here in the front tire and cannot go very, very far with it. So here are some ideas of requirement for quantum computation. So these are the three requirements that Peter talked about yesterday. Preparing the state, doing something with that state, and reading it at the end. And I added one of them, having some kind of hilbert space or kind of physical element which represent the information. So we need something which are qubits, or at least some kind of two-level system. So maybe the two-level system, let's say a nuclear spin pointing up or down, an atom being in the ground state or excited, a superconducting current, which will make a flux pointing up or down, could be example of qubits. They are two-level system, and they fit up with what kind of theorists think about how we should go and build such device. We have to prepare them in some state, and like a fiducial state that we start our computation with. Then we have to control them, the evolution, implement these algorithms. And then at the end, we have to go and make a measurement of this so that we can look at the answer of our problem. Well, these are really kind of a bouncing board for kind of a rough idea of what we need. Maybe sometime we can kind of cut up some of those elements. So if we really have measurement and measurements which are projective, and we know that once we've measured it, we've projected it's in a state that we know of, so then we can kind of get rid of the state preparation. So those two things are not independent. Might not be independent. But there's other devices like in NMR, we don't do projective measurement. We do what is called weak measurement. So in that case, we have to have a straight preparation which is independent. Second thing is quite often people say, here we need a qubit, and a qubit is a two-level system. But maybe we haven't kind of thought about very carefully exactly what is a qubit. Maybe it's slightly more general than only a two-level system. Like there's indication in the talk of Manik Neil of thinking about operators instead of thinking about state is a little bit more general, and then maybe we should kind of generalize this idea. So all these things should be things that we should challenge all the time and see maybe we can cut some little part of it or we can generalize, and we don't know exactly what are the minimal requirement of things that we have, but we can kind of use this as a first idea of kind of saying, do these criteria are satisfied in some device or not. So here's a list of devices suggested for quantum information processing. Not to suggest my bias, I put them in alphabetical order. So here's ion trap. The idea is to send lasers in counterpropagating wave, which will make little potential wells. You put atoms in there. Atoms nearby will start to interact with each other. With lasers, you can manipulate these systems. And so you can go and do some of these ideas. Ideas of cavity QED. You put photon and atoms in a cavity. They interact strongly. You can manipulate the information that way. Electrons floating on helium. You can put helium. Electrons can float on top of them. And the presence or absence of helium electrons will be the qubit or not. Ideas of ion trap, where we put a bunch of ions together in a trap. The ground and excited state of these ions are the qubit in our system. Nuclear magnetic resonance. Nucleus have spins. And we use a spin as our qubit. We could use radio frequency fields to manipulate them. And the natural interaction to couple them together. Idea of quantum optics, quantum dots, solid state, spectronics, superconducting Josephine junction. So what I was thinking to do is spend about half an hour on each of those. So that would kind of take about 6 hours, so we should be off by dinner time. So instead of doing this, as I imagine that slowly the audience would kind of go away, I'm going to talk about only three of them, ion trap, optics, and cavity QED, and NMR. And the reason why I chose those one is these are the ones where people have really realized some basic element of a qubit. And from I also talk very briefly on superconducting Josephson junction, where people believe they have seen superposition of state 0 and 1, which is the minimal requirement, and to a various clause on other places comes some basic element. It's important to think that we don't have quantum computers who do things that the classical computers cannot do today. They are typically very slow. But all this work on experimental quantum computation should be thought as a first step to try to understand how do we control quantum systems. And to show that it's not completely crazy to put information on single atoms, manipulate it, and extract it. And this is really where we are at in experimental quantum computation. So let's go to photons, photonic idea. So suppose that we send photons, and for some of you who heard Ephraim Steinberg's talk yesterday, you can think about photons as some of the qubits. There's an idea of using what is called a dual rail representation, using two photons or two modes, either in the state zero, one mode in the state 0 or 1, and the second one 0 or 1, in a certain superposition, instead of using the four states of the two modes, using only two of them, like 0, 1 and the 1, 0, which correspond to the logical or the state 0 of the quantum computer and the state 1 of the quantum computer. If you do this, then it's easy to do one bit gate in that system. I should pull out and make one little comment here, is that there's a theorem in quantum information theory saying that if we have one bit gate, if we can manipulate our qubit one by one, and if we can make them interact with each other, and roughly any kind of interaction works, then we can do all our algorithm in an efficient way. That the algorithm that people have described, then we can implement them with these gates in an efficient way. So we can relatively easily do one bit gate by taking one of the photons, one of the modes, and put a little piece of glass, and that's called a phase shifter, and that will shift this and bring, let's say if it is on the first mode, bring a phase here. Well, that's a little bit like a Z rotation, right? Here I'll have X, Y, Z being the Pauli matrices. So it's like a rotation around the Pauli Z matrices. If we have a beam splitter, piece of glass with a half silver mirror, and it doesn't have to be half silver with some silver in it, and how much silver you put will change this angle here. If we do this with a certain amount of silver to determine the beta, we can do a wire rotation. So with the Z rotation and Y rotation, because they cannot commute, we can induce the X rotation. And because these things, phi and theta, are arbitrary, we can also do any of the X rotations. So with photons, we're very good at doing one qubit rotation. The problem comes when we go and try to do two-qubit interaction. Well, there's something which is called a Kerr media, or nonlinear crystal, to the same thing. But the efficiency of these things are very weak, and we cannot send two photons, make them interact directly, and make them go at will in a deterministic way. So we are having a problem with the Kerr media, and we are getting in trouble with photons. So one of the advantages of the photon idea is that quantum optics is very well developed. Lots of ideas of how to do the one and two bit gate, a lot of precision experiments. Photons are cheap. Like, it's really easy to produce photons. But there's a funny rule here, is that it's really easy to get lots of photons, but when you try to reduce the number of photons and having a device which emits less and less amount of photons and go down to one, it becomes more and more expensive. So it's expensive to have few photons and cheap to have lots of them. And you get into trouble with this. One of the great things is that you can do this at room temperature. You don't have to go to very, very low temperature to do this experiment. And the reason of this is that photons interact very weakly with their surroundings. But this is a great thing because they have very low decoherence time. But it's a hard thing because it's very hard to make them interact with each other. And in fact, there's some kind of, not a contradiction, but something that we have to balance in any device who does quantum information processing, which is the ability of having two things, and the two qubits interacting with each other very strongly, but at the same time not interacting with the rest of the universe so that they would be clear. So it's very hard to find a system which kind of balance, as a balance act of those two things. So there was a suggestion much before, like, the big fashion on quantum computation, by Gerald Milburn at Brisbane to use photons for quantum computation. And what he showed is how to do what is called a Fredkin gate, or which is equivalent to some level of a tough little gate, a control knot, or something of that form, using Mach Zehnder interferometer and one of those Kerr media. There were ideas of going on this and going look at the possibility of what we can do with all of this. If we want to go beyond this the Kerr media problem, we can go and think about cavity QED. And the idea there is to have a small cavity here, which will catch a photon and an atom together and make them interact for a longer period of time. So you have, very nicely, you can think of the photon bouncing around here and then having your atom being stuck in there. And so you can increase the time of interaction and then increase kind of having a Kerr media in some sense, which would work on a single photon which comes in there and with a kind of relatively large strength. So Jeff Kimball and Caltech in 1995 showed that he could make one of those nonlinear interactions with only two photons coming in the air, and he showed that he could get a phase shift of about 17 degrees. Well, ideally, we'd like to have any kind of angle in there going from 0 to 90 degrees and be able to make those operations. But he showed that at least it was possible, but it would be very hard to go to values much larger than 17 degrees, so about 1/8 or quarter of a polarization. But it showed that that was one possible direction in which we can go and think about quantum computation. Using very similar ideas of cavity QED, Serge Haroche's group in Paris looked at what is called Rydberg atom. So his idea was to excite atoms, like the larger electron in the atom, to a very large value of n equals 51 and 52. 51 and 52 would be the 0 and the 1 state. Make them pass through one of those cavities, and because they have a large electric dipole, they would have a strong interaction with the photon mode. These are in kind of very strong cavity also. So we increase the time of interaction in the system. And he was able to demonstrate control of systems in there with about 2 or 3 qubits. So here the idea is they heat the atom to excite them, send them at a certain velocity, and the velocity is what controls how long it's going to go in this cavity and interact. The velocity is selected so that we are sure that the atom goes at, let's say, 300 meters per second. So once we know this to a great precision, we know that it's going to go through this cavity here, interact with the photon field for a certain, very precise amount of time, and then it gets out on the other hand, get detected, and we can see what happened in there. So with this idea, he was able to demonstrate Rabi oscillation. This is the idea of making a superposition of the 0 or the nth equals 50 and nth equals 51 state, and for various degrees that he wanted. So by doing this, so by changing the time at which the velocity of this thing, changing the time at which this thing was in there, he could make a small superposition of 0 and 1, a larger superposition, and increase this. He was able to do this so that the superposition of 0 and 1 was going from completely 0, then 0 plus epsilon 1, 0 plus 1 over square root of 0 plus 1 over square root of 2 of 1, up to going all to the 1 and then come back. And he was able to do this oscillation between 0 and 1. And in these experiments, you can go to about 3 or 4 of those oscillations before decoherence rule out. So one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to make a table here. You won't be able to see it because of the light during the talk, but when I finish, we'll kind of go back and look at how different technologies compare. Well, so for photon, let's say we have cavity QED, number of qubits which have been kind of manipulated in cavity QED with the ideas of Serge Haroche, he is able to go to about 3 qubits. And the idea of what he does there is he sends one atom, goes in and interacts with this electromagnetic field in here, and then the atom goes through, and then he sends a second atom, which comes in and interacts with the same electric field. So you can send information from one atom to another one via the cavity mode. And you can send a third one, and with this, you are able to entangle 3 atoms together and demonstrate properties of quantum mechanics after this. Second element, at some point we should be interested in, at what speed these things go, and the number of operations that we've done. So if you send 3 atoms in there, and you've entangled them, then let's say that, let's be generous and count the interaction of the atom with the cavity, and then the cavity back with the second atom with the cavity, and the cavity with the third atom. That's about, let's say, 4 or 5 operations. There is maybe somewhere I should put Rabi oscillation, which is if you do only one atom, then change how long it interacts with the cavity. How can you do this? Let's see. about 3 Rabi oscillations in that device. So all these systems, although demonstrate the basic idea of quantum computation, the idea of having a device with 1,000 qubits seems to be rather, rather daunting, because all the little imperfection, if you have a speed of atoms which comes in here, you know, any kind of imperfection in that device is going to increase a lot. And we can see with 3 or 4 is already incredibly hard. To multiply it, you would have to have everything kind of doing, getting better and better and better. So we might try to think of using photon in a completely different way. I said I was going to talk only about experiments which have only demonstrated qubits. I'm going to break my rule already and suggest one idea of how to go using photons, build quantum information processing device using linear optics. It's an idea that Manny Knill, Gerard Milbert, and myself had. And the basic idea is to use beam splitters, phase shifter again, where we add two things, single photon detectors, single photon source. These things exist around us, but they're not precise enough to make this scheme efficient today. But maybe if we kind of improve on these devices, we'll be able to do things in a different way. This is rather surprising, because the way how it works is rather different than the devices that I've mentioned already and that I will mention in the future. Up to now, people have thought about doing quantum computation as improving unitary transformation that we're doing and make these unitary transformation more and more and more and more precise until we arrive to this accuracy threshold. But error correction tells us that it's all right not to do exactly unitary transformation as long as we are within this threshold. We can screw up a little bit. As long as we know we screw up, then we can apply error correction and go and kind of undo the bad thing that has happened. Here we're going to do something which is incredibly drastic, which is if we use only linear optics, we don't have this non-linearity which is essential. When we do measurement, there's an implicit non-linearity which comes in here. So we're going to make measurements quite often. And at first sight, you would say, oh my God, if you start to make measurement too often, then you're always going to go and corrupt your quantum information. It turns out that this is incorrect. You can screw up half of the time in your gate and still get the information correctly, as long as you have a very precise type of error, you know where the error occurs, and you use error correction in that way. And this is the basic idea behind this quantum optics. It used two elements, one of them which came from Mike Nielsen and Ike Twang. The idea of if we do quantum teleportation, we can make a gate between two systems by teleporting the system and making a gate, or inversely, making the gate on a prepared state and then teleport. Well, when I first heard of that idea, I said, what is the difference? Like, it's very hard to make a gate before or after. But if you have operations which are not successful all the time, then this idea becomes very, very useful. Because a prepared state, even if it fails, you know that it fails, then you throw it away and you start again. And then you can, only when it is successful, you can use it in the teleportation. So with this idea of teleportation, you can get around of the fact that the system does not, the operation is not successful all the time. With the errors which are left, you're going to go and use error correction and take care of it. So I'm not going to talk more about this, except to tell you that if you are interested, then there's this paper by Manny Knill and Al that you can go and read. So let's go to a different technology, ion trap. So the idea there is to have atoms, ions, they are charged, so they will repulse each other, try to bring them within each other using radio frequency field in a trap, which will approximate to a very good level an harmonic oscillator. So let's think about a set of ions, let's say 4, on an harmonic oscillator, and we want them to do information processing. So the first thing that has to be done here is cool these ions to the ground state of that system, of the harmonic oscillator, and we're going to use the harmonic oscillator, or the phonon modes in here of this oscillator, to talk between one ion to the other. So the idea is you send a laser pulse at a frequency which is slightly different, slightly unresonant compared to the ground and excited state of the ion, enough so that it excites the phonon mode. By doing this, you're going to create a phonon mode conditionally on what is the state of the ion. And then you can focus your laser beam on the second ion and then absorb this phonon. And you can transfer energy, transfer information from one atom or one ion to the other using this process. There's difficulty on cooling this thing to the ground state, but this has been done by a different group of David Weinlein at Nice, group of Rainer Blatt at Innsbruck, and group of Walter in Munich. And the number of ions that people have been able to manipulate up to now is 4. Here is a picture of the trap of the NIST trap. The size of this is, if I remember well, about a centimeter. The size of the trap, which is just hidden in the middle, is a few millimeters. Here is a picture of 2 beryllium atoms. The distance between those 2 atoms is a few microns. So with the system, they have been able to go and manipulate 2, 3, and 4 ions and demonstrate, kind of, again, basic ideas of quantum information processing. So if we look at ion trap, number of qubits, roughly 4, number of operations. When they did 4, they did a very few number of operations. They just excited one mode, which was taking all the ions in some very specific state. But they do single bit rotation, a little bit with this, so let's say a few operation. Speed. What speed do the single, the phonon mode in here, is, which is the lowest interaction in the system, is about megahertz. So let's put megahertz down here. Number of B oscillation, I think it's around 10 in this system. So that gives us an idea of about after 10, the currents come and affect your system, and then you cannot do much more. So the difficulty right now is that these traps in here heat the ions, and although they have a rough idea of what is the origin of this, they have not been able to kind of get rid of this heating completely. So there's still some unknown reason of why this thing is heating at a rate much faster than what they had expected. When we start to cool more and more ions, the complexity of the cooling increases. So there's an idea of, instead of having a linear track here, to have something like a rail track type system where we have, let's say, rail track 1, 2, and 3, and 4, and 5, having a bunch of ion in each of them, cooling them in these rail track, and then have a common track where if we want an ion of rail track 2 interact with the one with 5, bring them on this common track and then make them going that way. And this way, we would, in principle, we could get rid of the difficulty of the complexity of cooling higher number of qubits. There's also a difficulty to address different qubits. Right now, the tighter the trap, the easier it is to cool. But the tighter the trap is, the harder it is to address them one by one. The NIST trap, the NIST people, for example, have not been able to address the ion tunnelly independently using a laser which would point on the first one and the second one independently. They've used tricks to use their 2 and 3 and 4 qubit experiments to do single qubit rotation, but these don't generalize to a higher number of qubits. Another difficulty of this linear trap also is that we don't have parallel operation. We cannot do parallel operation. If the memory, so if we go back to the accuracy threshold, this is a problem for the system. If we go over to the rail track idea, then maybe we'll start to get some ideas which would go with this. But there are still some nice demonstration of, again, foundations of quantum mechanics that we are really able to control small quantum system in a very reasonable way. Another device is superconducting Josephson junction. There, only in the last 2 years that people have been able to demonstrate that they really had a qubit, and in still some parts which are controversial. So the idea of using a qubit in there is not new. Well, they didn't call it qubit 20 years ago, but people were interested in ideas on foundation of quantum mechanics, making what is called a Schrodinger cat, a superposition of two macroscopic states. And what a superconducting device would do as a qubit would be a macroscopic superposition of flux. Like, you have a ring, which is superconducting, so if the electrons all go in the same direction, the flux would point up. This is the zero, or the qubit of our system. If we switch the direction of those electrons going, then they will point down, then it will be the one of our qubit. And although people have seen flux pointing up, flux pointing down, nobody yet in these devices have shown to be in the superposition of pointing up and down, or kind of 0 plus 1 at the same time. There's some indirect evidence that this has occurred. So 20 years ago, people started this. Claudia Tesch was one of the first ones trying to do this. She did not have enough sensitivity to demonstrate some of her effects. Her system was not isolated enough for the environment, and there was probably high decoherence. But today there's evidence that there is some superposition effect in this. There's two basic ideas. I mentioned the flux one. There's an idea of also charge, of having just one extra Cooper pair going in one system and the other, which would correspond to the zero or the one. And this was experimented, there was an experimental demonstration by Nakamura 2 years ago, which showed that there's a good indication that they can make a superposition of a Cooper pair and not having this last Cooper pair in one of those devices. And more recently, there's two groups, the group of Friedman in Stony Brook, the group of Hans Moy in Delft, who showed that there is a certain gap between the lowest or the ground state system in this. So you can think about this as the zero and the one. And if we have this two-level system in these devices, then the ground state becomes a superposition of zero plus one, let's say, and the anti-symmetric zero minus one becomes this, the first excited state, and there's a gap, and they were able to demonstrate or see that the difference between those two integer level and this gap. This is not yet a demonstration really of Rabi oscillation, but it does indicate that you are reaching the quantum level. If you would not be at the quantum level, it would seem that the state of the system would be either on one side pointing up or on the other side pointing down, and would not be on this superposition state. But again, it's not a demonstration yet of being able to manipulate this qubit continuously from top to bottom. So if we kind of go and look at number of qubits, well, tell them that it is one. Number of operation, we have zero operation right now. The speed of at which we would be able to flip a state from the zero to the one in there would be of the order of gigahertz. So that would be very fast, and that would be not only good for quantum computers, but maybe we can make them a little bit faster. It would be good also for classical computers. And that's some of the work that has been done in this area. So the last area that I will kind of look at is NMR, where the qubit there are, the qubit there are nuclear spins. So we have nuclear spins of certain atoms. There are atoms which have spin zero, no nuclear spin, so we don't use them in the system. But things like carbon 13, hydrogen, do have a nuclear spin, and we use them as our qubit. If you look very well in this picture, there's a chlorine atom in this molecule here. The chlorine atoms are spin 3 half. We could use them also for quantum computation. But it turns out that they interact very weakly with the spin 1 half particles. So for the experiments that we've been doing, then we can neglect them. In fact, what they do is they induce some amount of decoherence in our system. So here you could think about a 3-qubit system that you can manipulate. It turns out that even if those are both carbon atoms, the electron cloud around them is slightly different. It gives them a different Larmor frequency. And so we can distinguish between the first carbon and the second one. So we take these molecules, we put them in a strong magnetic field, and which gives a polarization, a little excess of up compared to down state, and then we can go and manipulate them. There's a coupling which goes between nearby qubit here. And this coupling is mediated by electrons which are in the S state. So you have overlapping of electron clouds between those two. And if the nuclear spin are pointing, let's say, up or down, it changes slightly the energy of the electron. Well, you can think about this the other way. And depending on having one qubit pointing up or down, then it the electron mediates an interaction through to having a presence at the nuclear spin on each side. So there is an interaction which is not really a dipole-dipole interaction of those two magnets next to each other, but there's an interaction which is mediated by the electron. The speed of this interaction, typically for hydrogen to carbon, is about 100 hertz. Hydrogen to hydrogen, you might go to 200 hertz. So in my little diagram here, I should put the speed of this thing, we'll say about 100 hertz to give us an idea. So we can manipulate the system because they have different Larmor frequency. So we can send, put a little coil around a sample of diluted molecules like this in a sample. The size of this sample is about the size of a pencil. There's about 10 to the 20 molecules in there. And this little coil is going to send radio frequency field. You hit them at the right frequency, let's say corresponding to carbon 1, then that induces a little magnetic field in that system. And because it's like a little magnet, this qubit, it torques it and make it rotate in the direction that you want. You have this two-qubit interaction, and with this you can build a quantum algorithm. The decoherence time, the time at which things happen, are noise comes in, the dephasing in the XY plane is about 1 second, the relaxation time 5 to 30, so let's say 1 second. So the number of radio oscillation that we can see is rather large, but let's be kind of more of a devil advocate and say that there's about 100 operations that we can do before this T2 time comes in, because we have about 100 hertz. So not radio oscillation, those we can see a lot, but the time at which kind of how many operations we can do is about 100. The last element that we need in all of this experiment is how to do the measurement. We do the measurement by taking the spin coil, but using it a slightly different way. When the spins are pointing in the XY plane, there's a torque with the strong magnetic field in the direction, they will rotate, they will induce a field, a current in this wire. So you can go and look at what this current looks like. It looks like this. It decays because of this T2 time. You can Fourier transform this, and then you'll have peak at this Larmor frequency. And depending what is the height of that peak, you can know what is the state of this molecule. So we have the qubit, we have how we do our operation, we have the measurement, and with all this we can go and do some different algorithms and see how we can implement ideas. Here's a list, it's not a complete list, but an idea of how many experiments on NMR quantum information processing have been done. It started in 1996 with the group of David Corey at MIT. And there's some missing here in the last range of the 2000-2001. And from 2 qubits, we are around today about 7 qubits. And most recently, to give you an example of kind of where we're at in all of this, in Los Alamos, we did the quantum error cracking code for a 5-bit code that used about 50 of those 2-gate coupling, about 350 of those single-qubit gates, and it's probably kind of the largest quantum algorithm that has been implemented today. And it gives us an idea of where the trouble comes from and where do we have to go in the future. Here's a little example of how NMR things work. Here's a very simple quantum algorithm. It's a control NOT gate. If the first bit is in zero, then you can, it is not going to do anything on the second bit. If the first bit is one, it's going to flip the second bit. So if you want to translate this simple quantum algorithm in terms of a quantum circuit, you can rewrite this in terms of one-bit gate, which are those boxes. If you have very good eyes, you'll see this is a Y90, Z90, Y90, X90, and here is a coupling between those two qubits, a pi over 2 coupling. Here is what it looks like. So what I'm going to do is demonstrate it for only the first state here and the second one, the 0,0 and the 1,0. So the two spin are pointing up and up, carbon 1, carbon 2. This is the 0,0, and here we have the carbon 1 pointing down, carbon 2 pointing 0. We'll do the first Y90 rotation. We go down to here. And that's where we have, here we have a coupling. The coupling is called a ZZ coupling in terms of Pauli matrices, which means that if the first qubit is pointing up, it's going to do counterclockwise. If the first qubit is pointing down, the second qubit is going to go anticlockwise. And this is what we see. Whoop, up to here. Now we do those two rotations, the Z rotation and the Y rotation doesn't do anything because the first spin here is in the Z direction, this one is in the Y rotation, so nothing happens, so we're left only with X rotation. X is the one pointing out of the board, and this is going to bring the spin. To up and down. So indeed, this first one here ended up to 0,0 where it started. The second one started with 1,0, the two spins pointing opposite direction, and ended up to down. So here's an example of how a very simple quantum algorithm can be implemented in this device. And what do we need to do to the spin so that they do that operation? Of course, if you do an experiment, this little diagram is not sufficient. You have to translate this in such a way that your apparatus does the right thing. Here's a language which translates, and at the end what we need is the NMR spectrometer, which is a software which kind of directs what are the pulses and the delay that we have to do. So here's the language of a pulse on the carbon 2 with a certain phase on channel, which is kind of the first amplifier. Then we wait 3 microseconds, we wait another 3 microseconds, it takes time for the electronics to catch up and kind of settle down. Here's a delay time which corresponds to this pi over 2 coupling. Here's some more delay and then the pulse which corresponds to the next pulse up here which comes in. And that's how this gets implemented in the particular devices. I've mentioned NMR. Well, we know very well that the liquid state NMR, like having molecule in a solvent, has difficulty because part of it is we are at room temperature. So there'll be some decoherence time which comes in. There'll be a limitation because we start with highly mixed state, and I haven't mentioned that in detail, but every time we add 1 qubit, our signal goes down by a factor of 2. And we also have the impossibility of reset qubits. Like we start an algorithm with all our qubits, we have to do all the algorithm and then look at the answer. If we have things like an ion trap or the superconducting Josephson junction, at some point we might be able to go and read something, reset the qubit to 0 and do error correction, for example, and then an iteration. We cannot do that at NMR. Here's a suggestion by David Corey's group in collaboration with us and Los Alamos of how we can go one more step than liquid state NMR, which is a solid state NMR implementation, where we can get polarization of 1, getting rid of this problem of having a signal decreasing by a factor of 2 every time we add a qubit. Higher clock rate, instead of having 100 hertz, we'll get to tens of kilohertz. That thing could be fast again, but enough to do more things. And the important point is not only the clock rate, but the ratio between the clock rate and the decoherence time. And there's expectation that the decoherence time is not going to change drastically between the solid state and the liquid state. So then we would gain the ratio between clock rate to decoherence time would increase by a factor of about 100. Finally, we'll have a possibility of erasable register if we are able to use acoustic NMR and kind of reset some of the qubit there. So this is work in progress, and we're just kind of starting this project. To go even further in the NMR direction, there's an idea of boost gain, where everything that I've done that has been done up to now in NMR, one of the difficulty is to measure nuclear spin. The smallest amount of nuclear spin that has been measure today is roughly of the order of 10 to the 6th of them. We cannot go and measure every qubit one by one. The idea of boosting is to go to that limit, and instead of having a molecule that we have to synthesize to do quantum information processing, to make an array of phosphorus atoms, to have a set of gates on top. The A gate would be able to control the one bit rotation. The J gate here will be able to bring electron clouds together so that there's an effective interaction between the phosphorus nucleus here and the one there. And at the end of this, having a device which will be able to measure single bit nuclear spin, and with this, go and solve some of the problems which was in the presentation, in the suggestion that I had in the previous transparency. So if we all take this together and we go and look at where do we all stand with this, number of qubits, I get to this table. So let's number of operation F about 1, because we can do only one interaction. So with photons, we can go up to 2 qubits. In fact, I think Dick Buemister has been able to go to up to 4. There's been work on GHD. So let's be generous. There's been about 4 systems which can be correlated with each other, who can do some manipulation. Number of operation is very hard to make them interact all together. But if they had 4, they must have had, let's see, 3 interactions with each other. Speed, I don't know exactly how to say the speed for the photons, so this, I'm not totally sure of what we say. Number of radio oscillation for single qubit on photon, this is very, very large, because the decoherence time is very large. But when you look at number of operation, then you see that the 2 qubit gate, which is the hard part of this one, that's roughly that way we would get. If you go to cavity QED, you can do more number of operation. Number of qubit is roughly the same. Number of radio oscillation, however, goes down. These systems are much harder to deal. This is kind of, I will take the Arrosh QED. And that gives you an idea of speed. It's the time at which 2 atoms can descend in this little trap. They go 300 meters per second. You don't want them to be at the same as the trap. The size of the trap is about a few millimeters, so it's not incredibly fast to do some of these things. Ion trap, they can go up to 4 ions. Number of operation, they can do a few megahertz, is a kind of clock rate, and number of Rebbe oscillation, then they can probably go up to 10. Superconducting, they have probably 1 qubit. Number of operation, then they would not be able to do it, but they would be able to do it at gigahertz when they are able to kind of do something. Rebbe oscillation, they have some superposition. NMR, can go up to 7 qubits, number of operation, about 50. Speed, 100 hertz. And a number of Rebbe oscillation, so I won't say Rebbe oscillation, I'll say number of operation, this is the hard thing. Rebbe oscillation, you can do lots and lots and lots of them. It's about 500 megahertz compared to 1 second, so you can do quite a lot of those things. One thing which is interesting to look is the slower the gates are right now, the larger the number of qubits. So slow seems to be great. And it's not totally surprising, because we're just learning how to control the system. If they behave slowly, then we have classical computer around this, which kind of go and time everything and do things correctly. When we start to go to gigahertz, then we have to be sure that kind of all the electronics kind of follow this. Because one thing which is incredibly important for physics implementation is to be sure that you are following the system very, very, very well. Like at the clock rate, every time you do a gate, it has to be exactly on time of this Rebbe oscillation. If not, you're going to be coherent. So that gives you a picture. If I would be daring, say, future, where will we be? Well, in my abstract, I said I'm going to do some speculation. So I'll say that in 5 years from now, there'll be half a dozen of implementation which will reach 10 qubits. 20 years from now, well, Peter yesterday night told me that he was hoping that we might have quantum computers in 20 years from now. I think it's too hard to know. And it's too hard to know because I have this feeling that we might not be thinking about implementing quantum information the right way today. But we have to go through this hard process. It's probably like maybe vacuum tubes is even a complement for what we've been doing in kind of the analog for quantum information processing. Maybe we still have vacuum tube, but maybe abacus. And we have to find the right way to control the system. And it's not obvious because we are just starting to manipulate the system. And what I've liked with this idea of linear optics is that it's a different way of controlling systems. Up to now, we've been on the side of saying these systems are very fragile, so we have to be very gentle with them. And we have to try to do things very, very, very precisely. But maybe we can manipulate quantum information by hitting it hard all the time, but in a very precise way. Screwing up all the time, but knowing where we screw up and how. And if we know this, then there's some hope to go in the right direction. So I have not written anything about the future in case somebody takes a picture and then I get into trouble. But I would hope that in 5 years from now, then we have about half a dozen of devices which has 10 qubits. And then we'll be able to understand which are the best ones, where we have led astray. And there's a good thing I didn't put something. Now Charlie is taking a picture. So I think there'll be a lot more to quantum information than just trying to...